Begin again. The second pitfall in moral reasoning that I need to bring to your attention is the pitfall of unteachability. Not only is it wrong to be overly taught by your traditions, if you will, it's also wrong to be completely unteachable. An unteachable spirit is, in a real sense, the root of heresy. For you see, a man who makes a mistake in his teaching before the congregation, before the church, is not simply because of the mistake in interpreting the Bible or drawing a doctrinal conclusion, a heretic. A heretic is a person who makes such a mistake and is unteachable with respect to the mistake, who cannot be admonished, exhorted, or shown the error of his way. And a person who persists in his error is a man who will not take instruction from others. Obviously, an unteachable spirit demonstrates an arrogance which is contrary to the fruit of the Spirit described for us in the New Testament, and it misses the effects of sin, the fallibility of men, just because they are sinners. To be unteachable is to say that I have nothing to learn, and therefore the cognitive influences of sin, the noetic effects of man's fall, have been eradicated in my life. I don't need to be taught of others. So an unteachable spirit would be the second pitfall in moral reasoning that mature moral reflection would want to avoid. There's another pitfall in moral reasoning that's related to traditionalism and unteachability, and that would be complacent arbitrariness in our opinions. Complacent arbitrariness is the attitude that shows no concern for justifying your own thinking. You've got your conclusions, and that's really all that counts. You know what you believe, and as far as being able to give a defense of what you believe, to clarify what you believe, to answer critical questions about what you believe, to thwart challenges to what you believe, you simply say, I believe it, and that's all there is to it. Complacent arbitrariness in one's own convictions, where there's no careful clearing of evidence, no scrutiny, no reasoning with respect to what you believe. A related but fourth pitfall to moral reasoning would be appeals to emotion, or mere emotional appeals. I don't want to say that any appeal to emotion is illegitimate in the Christian life. Emotions are very legitimate in the Christian life, and it's quite legitimate to appeal to emotions, for instance, in the pulpit when you're trying to persuade people or motivate people. However, the appeal to emotion cannot justify moral conclusions. It may drive moral conclusions home, but it cannot justify moral conclusions. Obviously, any appeal to emotion is a double-edged tool. If you can appeal to emotions in one way, you will generally find that your opponent, the person who takes an opposite point of view, can appeal to other emotions and try to persuade people of his conviction as well. For instance, let's say I try to appeal to your emotions favoring something of a perverted version of capitalism, whereby you never share any money that you have with the poor, you never show any charity, because, after all, if you want to really be loving toward other people, you'll teach them industry and self-reliance, and you'll teach them to be able to hold their heads up high and to say, we never depended upon anybody else. And so now we start appealing to emotions. Isn't that what you want? And besides, aren't you free? Aren't you in a position to do what you want to do and be your own person? We can start appealing to a sense of pride and self-reliance and self-guidance and all the rest. And then obviously the people who believe in supporting the poor can appeal to other emotions, emotions like sympathy and the good feeling that one gets by helping his fellow man and being his brother's keeper and that sort of thing. The appeal to emotion is a double-edged sword. It cuts two ways, and therefore it cannot be used to make, if you will, a decisive judgment as to the truth or error of a moral judgment. There's a great difference between finding acceptable moral principles and getting people to practice those acceptable principles. Appeals to emotion can be used simply to cover up pitfalls, prejudice, and vulnerability in one's thinking. Well, a fifth pitfall in moral reasoning would be that of narrowness and inconsistency. Narrowness and inconsistency. Not considering all of the factors that are involved in a moral decision, but engaging in simplistic reasoning. Simplistic reasoning. You know, the person who says, well, this is a rather simple matter. And these people in Iran have taken our hostages, and that's an act of war, and consequently we'll just go to war against them. Now, maybe that is the correct conclusion to be driven to, but to say that that's all you have to take into consideration would be the pitfall of narrowness, just focusing on one aspect of a very complicated situation and thinking that you can make a decision simply on that. Because you can generate some kind of enthusiasm and clarity with respect to one aspect of a complicated moral problem doesn't mean that you have mastered the problem or have in any sense a health-giving solution to it. In many people, the concept of morality, by the way, never develops beyond a childhood stage of such simplistic reasoning. Thus, many adult practices which were irrelevant to children are taken as outside the sphere of ethics by people. You can imagine a businessman who is, because in his childhood days, taught that honesty pertains to never taking cookies from people you know or hurting somebody that you can see, nevertheless engaging in business practices that are quite detrimental to his employees down the bureaucratic line or to his competitors or to his society. And yet, when confronted about the moral implications of his behavior, figures, well, this is not a matter of dishonesty on my part, because dishonesty is taking something from somebody you know and dishonoring a friend or stealing cookies from your mother or something. I mean, he's very narrow in his conception, and so his response to this challenge about his business practice is, business is business. See, this follows outside the sphere of ethics. He has a very narrow approach to what ethics is. Think of the tender father, the person at home who shows great compassion for his children, who is nevertheless, between the hours of 8 and 4:30, a ruthless businessman who doesn't worry about his victims because they're always distant and unseen to him. A pharisaical interest in the law of God, by the way, is often inconsistent and narrow in just the sense that I'm talking about. A pharisaical interest in the law of God. There are some people who get enthusiastic about the law of God because, if you will, they have a hobby horse that they want to support. And to the degree that the law of God supports their hobby horse, then they're interested. But to the degree that the law of God calls for reform in other areas of their life, or humility before the throne of God, or downright change and sanctification in their attitudes, then they don't want to hear that. A pharisaical interest is a narrow interest. Impartiality must characterize our ethical decisions, is another way of putting what I'm saying. Impartiality in the sense that all the relevant factors are going to be given their due weight, and we aren't going to be biased toward this, that, or the other, depending upon our own preconceived notions. Men do have a remarkable, indeed one would say a great ability, to believe inconsistent propositions. Although the orthodox dogma of many philosophers is that once you uncover a contradiction, that shows how unbelievable something is. The fact is, people believe contradictions all the time, usually without being aware of it. A sixth pitfall of moral reasoning that we need to take account of is that of rationalization. Rationalization, searching for evidence after you've come to a preconceived or a desired conclusion. You've come to your conclusion, but now you're going to look for supporting evidence. That's rationalization. Rationalization is like dismissing a taxi once you've reached the desired destination. It evidences prejudgment. Prejudgment, or what we call prejudice. Prejudice. You have your conclusion in mind, and you simply use the device of moral reasoning, like a taxi, to get you to the preconceived conclusion, your prejudged conclusion. So that in practice, we're usually just looking for reasons for what we've already decided to do already. We're not looking for reasons to help us decide to do this, that, or the other. In a sense, rationalization is the attitude that says there must be some reason why I'm right. I mean, I know that I'm right, no question about that, but now I've got to find some reason for why I'm right. I think rationalization is especially insidious as a pitfall in moral reasoning because it usually masquerades under the banner of duty. It's very easy to delude ourselves as to our motives, very easy to engage in self-deception about why we're doing what we do. For instance, when we are late for an appointment, we usually think, well, people should be courteous and give us a break. When others are late to our appointments, they're impolite. So two lines of thought can be taken to the matter, depending on what your perspective is. A person who holds out his conclusions to the end in an argument, if he is yourself, is usually a principled individual. And if he's your friend, very often, he's firm. And if he's an enemy, he's downright pig-headed. It's the same action. It just depends on the perspective you bring to it. Now, rationalization, you see, masquerades under the banner of duty, but usually partakes of this very subjective and relativistic perspective on things. Which line you hop onto in terms of your moral reasoning is often governed by the goal you have in view to begin with. It was like flying out here on an airplane. I knew where I wanted to go, and so that's the, you know, I chose to go to that gate and board that plane because I knew where I wanted to go. Now, whether you jump on the plane that's critical of the person for being late or jump on the plane that says, well, we're going to excuse this behavior is often determined on where you want to get with your words at that moment. I mean, under these social circumstances and given the interpersonal dynamics, is this the time to make some points against this person? Or is this the time to woo his favor? So for the, often what we're trying to achieve determines the way we reason and judge matters rather than the, if you will, the merits of the case itself. Proverbs, the 18th chapter, verse 13, speaks, it seems to me, directly to the sin of rationalization. Proverbs 18:13 says, he that giveth answer before he heareth, it is folly and shame to him. Here's the person who gives an answer before he hears, you see, before he's got all the relevant evidence, before he's really weighed the factors and sorted them out and come to, if you will, reasoned judgment. Even before he hears what the evidence is going to be, he's already got his conclusion. The man who answers before he hears is a foolish man. And the last pitfall of moral reasoning we'll look at in these introductory remarks is the pitfall of qualifying our moral judgments to the point of triviality. Qualifying them to the point of triviality. What we have here is the fault of making successive interpretations of your rule and adding to it a long string of qualifications and exceptions so that you can make your judgment end up coinciding with what is already approved of. That is, you state your bold hypothesis, and then you find out, well, there's resistance to it, so you qualify here and you qualify there. Now, that's probably pedagogically a legitimate technique for all of us. We need to learn that we, if you will, put up the trial balloon, we find mistakes, rough edges in our theories, and we qualify. There's nothing wrong with that. But the difficulty is, if we start qualifying, we can sometimes run with that qualification procedure to the point where there's nothing left of our original theory worth mentioning. I think of Christians who make a big point of saying, we are not to kill. The Bible says, thou shalt not kill. You know, just like that was just simple in itself, and you can make obvious applications. And then you say, well, what about in self-defense? Can't you kill in self? Well, okay, you can kill, but not in self-defense. Well, can you kill people who kill other people not in self-defense? That is to say, can you kill people as part of judicial execution of criminals? Well, yeah, okay, there's that qualification. Well, how about just war? What about when you're attacked and your country inducts you into service and you're called upon to kill somebody to defend your... Well, all right, in just war or defensive warfare. Well, what about cases of relieving somebody's misery? What if there's a pilot who... crashes to the ground and he's caught in the wreckage of his airplane and he's burning to death and you can't extricate him from the flames and he cries out to you from the flames to shoot him so he at least won't burn to death. I mean, is that an exception too? And I'm not going to take a position at least here on that issue, but somebody might be inclined to say, okay, well, that's another exception you can make. And so now that you're on to this procedure of making exceptions and qualifications and qualifications, eventually the person might come to the point where he says, well, I suppose the easiest thing to say is not that we shouldn't kill and then make all these qualifications. It'd be much easier to say simply, don't murder. Don't murder. That's my position. Thou shalt not murder. Well, that seems to take care of all the difficulties, but at the expense of not saying anything at all, because murder is precisely defined as the killing you should not do. Since murder is immoral killing than to say thou shalt not murder is simply to say thou shalt not do the killing that thou shalt not do. But now what that killing is, whether it includes ants and microbes and cancers and weeds and animals and all the rest, and whether it includes self-defense, warfare, and all these things, nobody would have any way of knowing. You've qualified your moral judgment to the point of triviality. There's no more informative content to this sort of thing than, of course, that famous statement of Calvin Coolidge, when large numbers of people are out of work, unemployment results. See, high-sounding, impressive, sophisticated remark about unemployment simply amounts to defining unemployment. When large numbers of people are out of work, unemployment results. So what I've been trying to impress upon you is that ethics presupposes mature reflection, and that mature reflection, getting beyond the stage of tradition, beyond the stage of other directed justification of your morality, just receiving from others the patterns of justification, appealing to emotion or what have you, ethics involves a commitment to avoiding these pitfalls and trying to come to conclusions that are well argued. Very often when people are puzzled about what they should be doing or what somebody else should be doing in a certain situation, what they need is not nearly so much further ethical information, but simply conceptual clarity, or if you will, further factual information. Often enough, the problems in ethics do not have to do with a failure of ethical guidance or being unclear as to the guidance. It has to do with a failure to understand the facts of our world, the facts of our situation, and not having the conceptual clarity that's requisite in bringing the facts and our principles together. The first step toward personal morality has got to be, because it is, in a sense, the least important step, but it's important enough to trip you up, you know, for the rest of the procedure of making a moral judgment if you don't observe it, is to attain conceptual clarity, consistency, and factual accuracy in your judgments. We all too readily acquiesce in ignorance and unclarity when it comes to our moral convictions and the way we live. Now, having said that, and I think it's absolutely necessary to say that to you, the fact remains that beyond these, what I'll call intellectual obstacles, intellectual in the sense that they are mistakes that most people who write on logic or philosophy could observe. It doesn't take, if you will, a great deal of moral wisdom and maturity to say the things that we've been saying thus far. Beyond those intellectual obstacles, there is also a difficulty in that we lack ethical guidance that is normative. When I say we lack, I don't mean that it's not at our disposal. I mean that we ourselves have not appropriated. We have not worked through our moral philosophy so that we have the ethical guidance we need. And so what we need is principles, and I mean here general principles, not simply illustrative cases or casuistry. We need to engage in a course of study that's going to turn up those principles of moral reasoning. They're going to help us to live better lives so that we can be servants of Christ, people directed by the Spirit, people who are witnessing to others and demonstrating that they truly understand doctrine. We need moral principles so that we can engage in truly moral living. And my first point this morning has been simply that ethics presupposes moral maturity, mature reflection, and commitment to a life directed by principles. And what is ethics? Well, I can begin by looking at what I think is the main interest of ethics in light of our discussion of moral maturity. Ethics seeks to bring our implicit or our unspoken code of behavior and value into the open in order that it may be scrutinized. Let me say that again. Ethics seeks to bring our implicit or unspoken code of behavior and value into the open in order that it may be scrutinized. We need to emphasize each aspect of this characterization. Ethics brings our implicit or unspoken code of behavior. Every judgment a person makes is implicitly a universal judgment. If I say, in this particular situation, you should not eat the orange, that seems like a rather particular situation. I'm talking about you, in this particular case, in this place, at this time, under these circumstances, with that orange, you should not eat that orange. seems very particular. But of course, in saying that, if I'm making an ethical judgment, I've committed myself to the principle that anybody else who is like you in morally relevant respects, and that is like you in terms of your situation in all morally relevant ways, should also not eat any orange, again, that is, in the relevant senses, like the orange that's before you. See, there's an implicitly universal judgment being made because I'm saying that everybody should do what I'm telling you to do when everybody has all the morally relevant circumstances that you do. Ethics seeks to bring our implicit or unspoken code of behavior out then. What I'm saying is when we make judgments, there's an unspoken code that guides the judgment. We have principles of morality that direct our thinking even when we don't feel that we're reflecting very deeply on our principles. Moreover, you notice that it's not only an implicit or unspoken code we're talking about here, but it's a code of behavior and value. Behavior and value. As I'm going to say in just a few moments, ethics is more than simply talking about obligations with respect to actions. Ethics is, as well, making value judgments as to persons, motives, dispositions, and the like. So ethics brings our implicit or unspoken code of behavior and value into the open in order that it may be scrutinized. Ethics then offers an analysis of human behavior and character with a view to their appraisal. It offers an analysis of human behavior and character with a view to their appraisal. Now, we should probably add, so that there's no misunderstanding, that we're offering an analysis of human behavior and character insofar as they are the expression of effort and choice. Insofar as they are the expression of effort or choice. That is to say, we offer an analysis of human behavior and character when they are attainments. We are evaluating attained behavior or attained character. Let's say that if I reach into my pocket in this way, and that because of particular physical circumstances, a hole in my pocket is ripped wider, and all the money that I happen to possess falls out of my pocket, and lo and behold, right into a collection basket that's going to the relief of the poor somewhere. Okay, and without my even knowing it, I've contributed my whole fortune to the poor. Now, would that be is that something that is morally praiseworthy? Well, we'd say obviously not. It was just an accident. It wasn't a matter of attainment. It wasn't the result of choice. It wasn't a matter of effort. We don't evaluate accidental things, even if they lead to what would be ordinarily happy results in the world. And that's true of character as well. You know, we don't evaluate somebody morally on the basis of their shyness or other, if you will, more or less natural character traits. But we do evaluate people on the basis of things that are acquired, or things that are failed to be acquired, such as the ability to be kind to others and conscientious, the ability to hold your tongue when you should hold your tongue. There are character traits that can be developed, and we do evaluate them, even though we may not talk about the more or less natural traits that a person has because of his family environment or his heredity or whatever other etiology you want to give to those kinds of traits. And so ethics, in short, is moral philosophy. Moral philosophy because it's critical and general thinking about moral problems and judgments, especially critical and general thinking about the presuppositions and implications of morality. About the presuppositions and the implications of morality. The thinking which we seek to do about ethical problems and judgments is analytical. It's another characterization I can give you. Analytical because it seeks to be consistent and well-grounded in its opinions rather than haphazard and thoughtless in its opinions. So ethics seeks to bring our implicit or unspoken code of behavior and value into the open in order that it may be scrutinized, offering an analysis of behavior and character to the degree that they are the expression of effort and choice, with a view to their appraisal. And so ethics is analytical moral philosophy. And that's the basic characterization I'd like to offer for ethics. Now, we're going to be narrowing that till the point where we finally get onto the main track of what this course is about, and that is specifically personal ethics or personalistic ethics, what is sometimes called existential ethics, ethics dealing with the person and his motivation and his character traits and all the rest. In Christian circles, often called holiness of life. But I've given you a definition of ethics or a characterization of ethics that is broad enough to cover all the other realms of ethics, whether it's done by believers or unbelievers, whether it's done with respect to our obligations and rules, with respect to our moral character, or with respect to the goals that we're pursuing in our life. Let me add to this, and we're going to spend a little bit of time on it, that ethics is not simply the discovery or the study of right and wrong. Ethics is not simply the discovery or the study of right and wrong. It's not simply the discovery of obligation, if you will. Moral or ethical judgments are of various kinds. That's one of the leading defects of textbooks on ethics, that they tend to treat one kind of ethical judgment, one realm or subsection of the domain of ethics, as though it were the whole. Ethical judgments, moral judgments, are of various kinds. For instance, in some moral judgments, we say that a certain action or a kind of action is morally right or wrong, obligatory, a duty, ought to be done. We use words like that. We say of some particular action or of some particular kind of action, a class of similar actions, that it is morally right, it is obligatory, it is a duty, it ought to be done. But now, there's a completely different kind of moral judgment that is just as legitimately a moral judgment. In other cases, we talk not so much about actions being right or wrong, dutiful, obligatory, or what have you. In other cases, we talk about persons. We talk about their motives, their intentions, their character traits, and the like. Calling them morally good, morally bad, virtuous, vicious, responsible, blameworthy, saintly, despicable, or what have you. Now, these are not the sorts of predicates that we use when we're talking about moral actions. Now we're characterizing moral people or immoral people. That is to say, the things we talk about in ethical judgments and what we say about them are different. The things we talk about, we may be talking about actions or kinds of actions in one kind of judgment. In another one, we're talking about people and their character traits and their motives. And that's a different matter altogether. Well, not altogether, as though there were no logical relationship between them, but we're certainly attempting to say different kinds of things when we use these different judgments. And what we say about either actions or people and the qualities of people, traits, dispositions, and so forth, is different. On the one hand, we say that some are right and wrong, namely the actions. On the other hand, we say some are good or bad, namely the people. There are good and bad motives, good and bad people, good and bad character traits, and virtuous and vicious and saintly and despicable and all that. But we usually talk about obligation and duty and irresponsibility with respect to actions. And so we can distinguish what I'm saying, judgments of moral obligation, from judgments of moral value. There's a difference between a judgment of moral obligation, you ought to pay your taxes, and a judgment of moral value, you are an honest person. Okay? Moral obligation, you ought to do this, it is your duty, this action is laid upon you. Moral value is, it's good to be honest, always be trustworthy, something like that. And thus, we need to have a normative theory of moral value to supplement our theory of moral obligation. We need to have a theory of moral value that goes over and above our theory of moral obligation. Ethics is not simply then the discovery or study of what is right and wrong, obligatory actions. We are also interested in ethics in the question of what is good, namely, what is valuable. What are the conditions of moral responsibility? We could also mention, although it will not be subject for this course, what is deserved, what is justice. Ethics deals with more than obligation. And I think it's probably a besetting problem among many young Calvinists who are interested, for instance, in the law of God, that they don't see beyond that. They have a very narrow interest in ethics, as though ethics were simply a matter of duties and obligation, when as a matter of fact, just the simple use of moral vocabulary should point out to us that ethics is much broader than that. We're also interested in moral development, character traits, virtues, if you will, the cardinal virtues. We need to be interested in dispositions, the way people make their decisions, moral maturity. Motives, good and bad people, good and bad character traits, and virtuous and vicious and saintly and despicable and all that. But we usually talk about obligation and duty and irresponsibility with respect to actions. And so we can distinguish what I'm saying, judgments of moral obligation from judgments of moral value. There's a difference between a judgment of moral obligation, you ought to pay your taxes, and a judgment of moral value, you are an honest person. Okay? Moral obligation, you ought to do this, it is your duty, this action is laid upon you. Moral value is, it's good to be honest, always be trustworthy, something like that. And thus, we need to have a normative theory of moral value to supplement our theory of moral obligation. We need to have a theory of moral value that goes over and above our theory of moral obligation. Ethics is not simply then the discovery or study of what is right and wrong, obligatory actions. We are also interested in ethics in the question of what is good, namely what is valuable. What are the conditions of moral responsibility? We could also mention, although it will not be subject for this course, what is deserved, what is justice. Ethics deals with more than obligation. And I think it's probably a besetting problem among many young Calvinists who are interested, for instance, in the law of God, that they don't see beyond that. They have a very narrow interest in ethics, as though ethics were simply a matter of duties and obligation, when as a matter of fact, just the simple use of moral vocabulary should point out to us that ethics is much broader than that. We're also interested in moral development, character traits, virtues, if you will, the cardinal virtues. We need to be interested in dispositions, the way people make their decisions, moral maturity, holiness of life, if you will. So ethics is more than the discovery of right and wrong or obligatory actions. It's also interested in the question of what is valuable, what is good, what are the conditions of moral responsibility, and what is deserved, what is justice. Beyond the discovery of obligation, ethics needs to and ought to aim to find motivation for doing what is right. It's one thing to say the right thing to do is to help your neighbor. And it's altogether different to find motivation to help your neighbor. You know, making the judgment one ought to help his neighbor does not make somebody loving enough to help his neighbor, even though he knows that that is the obligatory line of action. Discovering right and wrong and doing right are in fact mutually dependent upon each other. And we return again here to this theme that I warned you would be recurring throughout our course. Discovering right is intimately related to doing the right. They are mutually dependent upon each other, so that we can say that a person who does not do the right will not clearly discover the right, and the person who has not clearly discovered the right will not be able to do the right. Right living and right thinking go hand in hand. And I hasten to add that they do not go hand in hand as horse and carriage. So that we can also say, don't get the wagon before the horse, so that the horse is pushing rather than pulling. It's not that way, although it's often portrayed simplistically, as though first we think about the right things and then we live the right way. The Bible says that living the right way helps us to think the right way about things as well. And so discovering right is mutually dependent upon doing right. Ethics must be practical as well as theoretical, and that's contrary to virtually all the secular opinions that I can find on the subject, all of which assume the separation of morality from epistemology. Secular ethics, I don't want to say universally because I just haven't done that much reading, but on a wide scale, it seems to me that ethics is separated from epistemology by most secularists. Epistemology is one thing, morality of behavior is another. For instance, John Hospers writes in his book on ethics, quote, "Finding true principles is not the same as acting upon them. Ethics is concerned to find the truth about these moral questions, not to try to make us act upon them." End of quote. Well, when I was reading that as a student of John Hospers a few years ago, of course that just jumped out from the page at me. Ethics is interested in finding out about right behavior. It's not interested in producing right behavior. Well, obviously, anybody who's had even a modicum of Christian nurture is going to say that certainly is a barren approach to ethics. That's, you know, like James saying, we can be hearers of the word, but we don't have to be doers. James says that hearing the word's not good enough. You must be a doer of the word. Bertrand Russell once said, propositions about practice are not themselves practical. Propositions about practice are not themselves practical any more than propositions about gases are themselves gaseous. Well, Russell, as he was wont to be, is clever in making this remark. But, of course, he misses his mark altogether because all he's pointing out is that there is a distinction to be drawn between objective duty and personal subjective behavior. And undoubtedly, we would grant that. The man who says, I ought to help the poor, is not necessarily the man who helps the poor. Man, observing an objective duty is not the same as doing one's duty, subjectively conforming to the norm. However, that distinction, the fact that you can say there's an objective duty and then there's a question of whether people subjectively conform to it, that distinction says nothing about what is required as far as the process of coming to know what is right. You see the confusion here? Both Hospers and Russell want to say there's obviously a difference between duty and whether we conform to our duty. Yes, there is. Mentally, we can draw the distinction easily. We can make interesting remarks about it. It's not practical to give a proposition about practice any more than it's gaseous to give a proposition or to utter a proposition about gases. However, it may very well be that coming to know what one's objective duty is, the process of learning, understanding, and applying one's duties, does require a lifestyle that is practical. You see, coming to know about these things may very well call for an integration of thought and behavior, even though there is a difference between what we think is right and what behavior we're going to render to what we think is right. Walking in the light and ethical maturity lead us to discern the Lord's will, the Bible says. We saw that in Romans 12 earlier this morning. We read that if we are being transformed by the renewing of our minds rather than conformed to the world, we'll be able to discern, to prove what is the good will of God. We're going to be able to know the will of God. We're going to be able to, if you will, prove its character, find it proper application if we are walking in the light. Now, the same thing is taught in Ephesians 5, verses 8 to 10. Ephesians 5, verses 8 to 10. For you were once darkness, but are now light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of the light is in all goodness and righteousness and truth, proving what is well-pleasing to the Lord. You see, because of the transformation of our character, we are able to prove what is right in the eyes of the Lord. You see, we are now, if we walk as children of the light, we're going to see the fruit of the light. We're going to be able to know the will of God better because we are conforming more and more to the will of God. And the same theme, which we're going to look at in more detail later in our course, comes up in Hebrews, the 5th chapter, verse 14. Hebrews 5:14. But solid food is for full-grown men, those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern good and evil. By reason of use, people gain moral maturity or spiritual maturity. And that maturity enables them, you see, to discern good and evil. Walking a moral path enables one to see the path better. The more practice we have at being moral in practice, living according to God's norms, the better we're going to be at discerning what good and evil are according to those norms. In full justification, you don't begin with knowledge and then come to the fear of the Lord. Now, on the basis of all the things you figured out, the knowledge that you have, you come to the conclusion, as evidential apologetics would have us believe, you come to the conclusion that the right thing to do is to bow before God. I've got this figured out on my own in terms of my intellectual autonomy, and now I'm going to morally bow before God. Proverbs has it just the other way around. First, one bows morally before God. He reverences the Lord. And that becomes the beginning of knowledge. That becomes the head of knowledge. That becomes the foundation, the crucial point, the outset for knowledge. We see this also in Jeremiah 22, verse 16. Jeremiah 22, 16. He judged the cause of the poor and needy. Then it was well. Was not this to know me, saith Jehovah. If there's any question as to whether we know Jehovah or not, notice that that question is going to be answered. It's going to be adjudicated on the basis of how we judge with respect to matters of morality. When a person judges the cause of the poor and needy, then it's said that he knows Jehovah. And those who will not judge the cause of the poor and needy do not know. What does James tell us true religion is? True religion is being able to recite Hodge's systematic theology. No. True religion is to do what? To take care of the fatherless and the poor. To visit those who are in need. True religion is evidenced, you see, in a lifestyle. A genuine knowledge of God is seen in the way that we live. John, the 7th chapter, verse 17, points this out as well. John 7, 17. If any man wills to do his will, he shall know of the teaching, whether it is of God and whether I speak from myself. There's some question, you see, whether what Jesus says is godly, whether it's from God or not. Jesus says, well, if you want to go through a procedure of discerning whether what I say is of God or not, then do the will of God. You see, those who are willing God's will, that is to say, those who are conforming to God's desire, those who are thinking God's thoughts after him, not in the intellectual sense, but in the sense that their lives are governed by what God's precepts say. Those who do the will of God will know of my teaching, whether it's from God or not. Now, we might have expected, especially given the kind of doctrinal context that we usually find ourselves in, and which is in itself all right. I'm certainly not, you know, going to put down what I'm going to say here in just a second, but we might have expected Jesus to say, go do your exegesis of the Old Testament, and then you'll know that what I say is of God. But here he gives another test, not simply the test of intellectual conformity to what has already been taught. He says the person who's doing the will of God will be able to discern. One more passage along these lines. 1 John 4, verse 7. 1 John 4, at the 7th verse, and there we read, Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone that loveth is begotten of God and knoweth God. And again, we're led to believe because of our doctrinal context and our emphasis upon doctrine, we're led to believe because of the intellectualism of our secular world as well, that somehow one knows God and then he comes to love God. And John says, no, we are supposed to love one another and love God because in that way you know God. Knowing God and loving God go hand in hand. One is inclined to say they are, in fact, identical. And John is just giving two different ways, two different perspectives on the same thing. One is called loving and one is called knowing, but they entail the same things. They require the same things. They amount to the same thing. There's a sense in which we can say that a conceptual understanding of something requires a certain kind of behavior. To possess a concept involves being able to behave in certain ways and in certain circumstances that are appropriate to that concept. Now, I have a young boy who is starting school this year. Let's imagine that he comes home from school and he tells me that he has learned to count by twos. He knows how to count by twos, not just regular counting, but he can count by twos. And I say, all right, Michael, count by twos for Daddy. And he goes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I said, well, now, wait a minute, Michael. Counting by twos calls for leapfrogging these numbers on the line. You've got to go every other one. So it's 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, or 1, 3, 5, 7, 9. And he says to me, I understand that. Of course. That's what counting by twos is. Okay, well, now, Mike, you count by twos. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You see, he says he knows the concept. And, in fact, it's conceivable that I could ask him and he could say, counting by twos amounts to leapfrogging the numbers. But every time I ask him to count by twos, he doesn't do that. Now, if that were true, and you might think, well, that's an unrealistic example. In that sense, it's a good one because it's pointing out what I want you to see. If we ever were in a situation where somebody said he had a concept but never lived or never practiced the concept when it came for the proper time, we would probably conclude, wouldn't we, he doesn't really understand the concept after all. And I've known so many people, and I've known so many instances in my own life, sadly, to confess, where the proper understanding of a concept in doctrine amounted to being able to say, oh, I know, you got to leapfrog the numbers. But when it came down to knowing, in the sense of living, that doctrine, it's another matter altogether. And there's a real question whether a person understands conceptually his doctrine before he knows how to behave in light of his doctrine. If the truth is not transforming him, if the truth is not giving him health, spiritual health, if his doctrine is not health-giving, there's a question whether he genuinely has the truth, genuinely has godly doctrine, the doctrine which is according to godliness, remember. Okay, my point has been in these last few minutes that ethics is not simply the discovery or study of right and wrong. It's much more than that. It's much more than the study of moral rules, much more than the study of obligations that can be put in legal form. Study of ethics is as well the study of what is good, what is valuable. It is aiming to find motivation for doing what is right. It amounts to trying to produce moral behavior as a means of conceptual clarity about morality. Ethics has to do with value, motivation, evaluation of people, dispositions, responsibility, and if you will, holiness of practice in life. What I'd like to offer you then in light of these remarks is something of an outline of normative ethics. In light of what we've been saying here this morning, an outline of normative ethics would include judgments about right and wrong, judgments of value, both judgments of right and wrong and judgments of value. The first of all, in our outline of normative ethics, we can speak of the discovery of an analysis of obligation and value. The discovery of obligation, and that pertains to actions. And we have the discovery of value, which pertains to persons and aspects of persons. For instance, their motivation, their character traits, that sort of thing. Okay, now in the theory of obligation, we can distinguish the theory of duty, or if you will, general moral judgments and applications. We have a theory of duty, as well as the theory of rights, what people are permitted to do, and finally the theory of justice or deserts, what people have coming when they live in this way or the other. Now, in terms of the discovery of value or the theory of moral virtue, we have the discussion of persons, what kind of people should we be, elements of persons, for instance, traits of character or virtues, as well as responsibility that people exercise or fail to exercise. Okay, now in addition to the discovery of obligation, duty, rights, and deserts, and the discovery of value, persons, elements of persons, and responsibility, we need to add to our outline that ethics involves the production, encouragement, and maintenance of morality. Ethics includes, then, the production, encouragement, and maintenance of morality. And as some subheadings, we might include, among many others, I think, training, education, exhortation, sanctions, renovation, moral growth, and motivation. The production, encouragement, and maintenance of morality involves moral training. What we usually hand over to the psychologist, sadly, involves moral training, moral education, exhortation. You see, a whole aspect of this course ought to do have to do with preaching, the beseeching of the congregation as, if you will, part of the production of moral behavior. It would include as well sanctions. And we might think here of the sanctions parents lay upon their children, the sanctions that a society lays upon its citizens, sanctions that a church lays upon its members, sanctions that we lay upon each other in our interpersonal relationships, sanctions we lay upon ourselves, and the eternal sanctions that God lays upon us. And so that's part of the production, encouragement, and maintenance of morality. Renovation, the whole discussion of regeneration, repentance, conversion, pertains to ethics, moral growth, as well as moral motivation. All these things are part of a normative theory of ethics, because ethics is more, to repeat my point, more than the discovery of right and wrong. It is also the discovery of value, judgments as to value, as well as working to produce right and wrong, not wrong behavior, but working to produce right behavior and valuable or good people. Okay, we've been talking then about the interest of ethics. The two points that I've made thus far, you can be sure you've got your outline at least something like mine, is that ethics seeks to bring an implicit or unspoken code of behavior and value into the open so as to scrutinize it, and secondly, ethics is more than the discovery of right and wrong. And of course, on each one of those points, we've done a great deal of onion peeling, you know, looking at a lot of different aspects of this and trying to take it apart. Now, I'd like to speak for a while, thirdly, on the distinctives of ethics. What makes the moral point of view a distinctive point of view? Distinctive from, say, the conventional point of view, or the artistic point of view, or the financial point of view, or the scientific point of view, or the historical point of view, or what have you. What is it that makes ethics distinctive in its outlook? And in order to bring home to you what is distinctive about the moral point of view, it'll be valuable to use a series of contrasts. And we can talk about these contrasts in light of ethics. Is ethics more like this or more like that? In what sense is it this and what sense is it that? And in this dialectical procedure, I think we'll be able to get a sense for the distinctive character of ethics. And the first contrast is that of descriptive, prescriptive. If you want to know what the ethical point of view is, it is prescriptive, it is not descriptive. It's more like what the doctor hands you, a prescription, telling you what to do, an imperative, if you will, than it is simply describing or observing what takes place. Now, this is not to say that ethics is, if you will, uninterested in descriptions or factual accounts of things, because the facts, after all, are very significant in ethical judgments. Ethics goes beyond, however, the simple observation of the facts and pronounces value judgments on actions, motives, character traits, individuals, institutions, societies, and the rest. People can agree on the facts and yet disagree in their ethical reaction to the facts. And thus, unlike psychology, unlike history, unlike sociology, unlike natural science, ethics is not merely descriptive, it is prescriptive. Psychology may tell us what our motivation is, but ethics proposes to tell us what our motivation ought to be. The next characterization, or if you will, contrast, in light of which we'll understand ethics better, is that of social and individual. Social and individual. When we come back together for our next session of this class, we'll take up at that point in what sense ethics is social and in what sense ethics is individual. Thank you.